today, President Obama signed an emergency disaster declaration for parts of Washington state as massive wildfires continue to burn there and in neighboring Oregon. The fires have already scorched nearly 1 million acres and destroyed at least 150 homes, including Libby Harrison's. She's the mayor of Pateros, Washington, and she spoke with residents about all they've lost at an outdoor town hall meeting.
I, myself, and family members have lost their home, and I just want you all to know that we as a community are going to pull together and make this town even better.
That tape from NBC News. Harrison's home was destroyed by the Carlton Complex fire in north central Washington. It's now the biggest wildfire in the state's history. Tom Bonsi is a regional correspondent for the Here and Now Contributors Network and the Northwest News Network. He joins us from the state capitol in Olympia. Tom, first of all, tell us what, you know, how large is this fire and what prompted the emergency declaration?
This, as you said, is a monster fire. It's nearly 400 square miles, and it's only 16% contained today. There are more than 2,500 firefighters and support staff assigned just to this one fire. It's destroyed at least 154 homes. But the good news is today the weather is helping. It's started raining last night. As I look out my window here, we're having just a beautiful, soft summer rain right now. That's going to help a lot.
Oh, help a lot. But I understand also that if it continues to rain in the region where the fires burned, that could signal a new round of worries for landslides, things like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is a mixed blessing. We just, in some ways, can't catch a break here in the Pacific Northwest this month. The National Weather Service has posted a flash flood watch for the eastern slopes of the Cascade Range and central Washington valleys through 11 o'clock tonight. And this is the area where that huge wildfire is burning, and a dozen others have also burned or recently burned. So the hillsides are denuded of plant life, and on those burn scars, then, when you get too much rain, there's the risk of mud and debris flow. So we're keeping our eye out for that today.
And to add insult to injury, so to speak, I understand that the fires took down a number of really essential electrical lines and power poles that have left a lot of residents who are already, you know, dealing with the fire and the smoke without electricity.
That's right. There are thousands of people without power, have been without power since the beginning of the weekend. And that's because something that I've never seen in years of fires, covering wildfires, is that the fires literally burned down the wooden power pole, not just a few of them, but the transmission lines from valley to valley, and then all the feeder lines to homes. And so the two affected local rural power cooperatives are saying it could be up to weeks before electricity is restored to some people, because not only do they need to restring the lines, but they need to find new power poles. And those are now in short supply, as well as the big machinery needed to sink power poles into the ground. And, you know, it's warm right now. It's the peak of summer. It's never a good time to lose your power, but it's 85 degrees. You really want your air conditioning on because you can't open your windows because of all the smoke that's outside.
Wow. So a lot going on at the same time because of these fires. And Tom, finally, I mean, you said that the fires were less than 20% contained. Any chance, I mean, what are firefighters saying about their chance of getting these wildfires under control or further contained anytime soon?
Well, they're feeling pretty good right now because the last couple days have been calmer than, especially with the wind, than earlier that is over the weekend. So they're making progress. The threat of losing more homes has gone down a lot. The fear now is that this cold front that's bringing the welcome rain will also set off a new round of lightning and thunderstorms. So just in the last 24 hours, there's been reports through the National Weather Service of 20,000 lightning strikes in the Cascade Ranges of Oregon and Washington. Now, most of that's coming with rain, so it's probably okay. But those tend to smolder for a couple days and then could spark a new round of wildfires. So definitely something the smoke jumpers are circling right now, mm-hmm. Especially out of Oregon, looking for those new starts so they can nip that in the bud.
Tom Bonsi is regional correspondent for the Here Now Contributors Network and the Northwest News Network. Tom, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And you mentioned President Obama's emergency disaster declaration for parts of Washington state. Well, the president may have actually seen the smoke from those wildfires yesterday when he was in Seattle on a fundraising trip. Today, he's in California. And earlier this week, he signed an executive order protecting lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender federal workers and contractors from employment discrimination. Just the latest executive order involving workers and their jobs and their pay. And many experts say there would be less pay discrimination if there were more transparency about what we are paid. Jonathan Tim writes about that for The Atlantic. He's with us from WBEZ in Chicago. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you started looking into this issue because of something that you were told by two separate employers. Tell us what they said.
Right. So the two different employers were a small local coffee shop that bills itself as being socially responsible and fair trade and all of the things that we're familiar with those kinds of coffee shops. And the other employer was a gigantic multinational law firm. And in different situations, both of them told me that I should really not talk with my coworkers about what I made.
Hmm. They both said that. And why? Did they explain why they didn't want you to do that?
Yeah. So in the coffee shop, the situation was that some of my coworkers had been grumbling a little bit about our tip system, and they said that it was unfair the way that it was distributed. And so when I asked my managers about it, they told me that they would prefer that I bring this kind of issue only to them and not talk to my coworkers about it. And they even added that the owner of the coffee company really hates it when people talk about money and would prefer that no one talks about it at all and would fire people for it if he could.
And the law firm?
And the law firm brought it to my attention when I was becoming a permanent employee out of a temp contract. And after we had discussed the salary possibilities and agreed to meet at a later time to come to a number, my HR manager just told me out of the blue that I should really not discuss my pay with any of my coworkers, as it can cause tension and people can get let go for doing it.
And as you write, that's actually illegal. Your employer should not be telling you not to discuss your pay with your fellow workers.
That's correct. The National Labor Relations Act of 1935 prohibited this when it strengthened the rights of all workers to form unions or what it calls engage in concerted activity for mutual aid or protection. It basically means that you can talk to your coworkers about what's important to you at work. And if you have an issue, you can meet with each other and talk about what you might want to do about it. And there are laws in different states that have made this more robust and protected workers more specifically. But it has been illegal technically to tell your employees not to discuss their pay for quite some time.
And yet almost everyone does it. I've been in jobs over and over again where people don't want you discussing how much you're getting paid.
That's right. I mean, I've experienced it as well. And after writing this piece, I've heard from, you know, innumerable people saying that they've dealt with this and some of them didn't know that it was illegal. It's part of a lot of different things. You know, we have a culture where it's somewhat of a taboo to discuss our wages at work, even when we feel like they're unfair.
Well, as we mentioned, President Obama recently signed these executive actions about pay transparency. One prohibits federal contractors from retaliating against workers who do discuss pay. The other requires contractors to provide information about pay to their employees. Those protect contractors. And then there's the Paycheck Fairness Act in Congress. Tell us what that does.
Yeah, what that would do is basically strengthen the penalties to employers that do violate this rule. So if they, you know, have a policy that says explicitly that their employees cannot discuss pay with each other, then the penalty against them would be stronger.
Although there are some who say that all this is going to do is bring a flood of lawsuits. The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has said this legislation would double down on job loss, all while lining the pockets of trial lawyers. In other words, it's just another Democratic idea that threatens to hurt the very people that it claims to help.
Yeah, it's an understandable concern, but there's not any evidence that when laws are enacted to better protect workers against pay discrimination, that there's a flood of lawsuits and that it really hurts business. This has happened in California, in Illinois, and I believe six other states, and there's no evidence that it's this, you know, typhoon of trial lawyers attacking businesses and harming them.
Well, why would new legislation be necessary if salary gag rules are already illegal?
Well, the reality is that even though they're illegal, they're extraordinarily common. 61% of employers in the private sector face these policies. And even in the public sector, where many know it to be transparent and to have a transparent salary structure, it's quite common there as well. So what we see is that the law hasn't really accomplished the goal that it set out to accomplish.
What about companies who say, look, I have two employees, I pay them different amounts, but that's because one of them is a lot better, a lot more productive, is working a lot harder than the other one. And I don't necessarily want the other one knowing that I'm paying employee A so much more money.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds fair enough. And there's plenty of room within the law to have a pay structure that favors one employee over another for various reasons. Where it becomes problematic is that if two people are in a position and one person believes that they're being paid unfairly, it should be their right, and the law says that it's their right, to maybe talk to that other employee and say, hey, I think I might be getting the short end of the stick here. You know, do you agree? And if so, what can I do about this? If the employee knows nothing about how the pay is distributed, they really don't have much ammunition in a discussion about whether they should be getting paid more.
Now, I'm not going to ask you this for real, because you're not just talking to me, you're talking to all of our listeners. But if I were to ask you how much you make, wouldn't you think that that was an uncomfortable question for you? Would you want to answer that?
I absolutely agree that it's an uncomfortable question. But, you know, I've also worked in the public sector before, and I know a lot of places, including private companies and universities, where pay is transparent. So, you know, it's not as if this is a taboo or a discomfort that we can't get over.
Jonathan Timm is a journalist based in Chicago. He wrote about salary gag rules for The Atlantic, and we've got that article at our website, hereandnow.org. Jonathan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hundreds of thousands of children suffer from some form of neglect, abuse, and trauma during their early years. And many of the psychological consequences are well known, but it's becoming increasingly clear just how damaging this early trauma can be to the developing brain. Today, in the final part of our series, Brain Matters, reporting from the front lines of neuroscience, Iris Adler from Here and Now contributing station WBUR looks at the key issue of brain development and the neurological consequences of early childhood neglect and trauma.
This is a picture of our family the day Peter was adopted. And it was 7 years ago, almost to the date.
Like any new mother, Braille was full of hope and excitement the day she welcomed her new son into her life.
And his dad is standing here with a big smile on his face, wouldn't you say that?
Yes.
And I'm bending over to kiss the top of Peter's head. I spent most of that day crying.
Peter, now 14 years old, was 7 when he was adopted. He'd been living in foster care after being taken from his biological mother. Around the dining table, Peter's family share stories of their son's early life, when he and his siblings endured years of neglect and abuse living with their biological mother and her violent boyfriend.
It was physical, emotional, continual.
The boyfriend, by the account of all the kids, was physically pretty aggressive towards them. On some occasions, forced them to eat chili peppers off the floor.
Peter and his parents, who chose not to use their real names, are very close, but the 7 years since the adoption have been challenging.
He was very sweet and affectionate, and then he would just fall apart and start banging his head against the wall or start screaming, and it seemed to be fear.
Getting punched would not be unusual.
Experts have long known that neglect and abuse in early life increase the risk for psychological problems such as depression and anxiety. But now neuroscientists are explaining why, by showing how abuse and neglect wreak havoc on the developing brain, causing physical damage to key brain areas.
So the way we do the EEG is we have these nets of electrodes, and they're sized from little babies up to adults.
At his lab at Boston Children's Hospital, neuroscientist Charles Nelson studies the effects of early childhood adversity on the brain's circuitry.
If I'm being physically abused, sexually abused, emotionally abused, then those circuits become abnormal. And as a result, the brain doesn't wire the right way.
So what prevents the brain from wiring the right way? And how does childhood maltreatment get biologically embedded in the brain? The thinking goes like this. If a child is abused or chronically neglected, it represents a profound threat to the child's existence. That sets off a biological stress response and a flood of hormones, many of which damage critical parts of the brain. Experts call the unremitting stress of abuse and neglect neurotoxic.
Let's say there's 1,000 neurons that are supposed to wire in a certain way. Well, maybe only half of them wire that way, and the other half wire in an incorrect way. So by altering the wiring diagram, you're going to alter behavior and alter psychological states.
Many animal studies have looked at the damaging effects of early neglect by putting young mice in isolation, for example. But in the year 2000, Dr. Nelson had the opportunity to study a population of neglected children, Romanian orphans raised in harrowing conditions in state orphanages.
As a neuroscientist, of course, the first thing I wanted to know is what effects are these experiences having on brain development?
Using new neuroimaging tools, Dr. Nelson compared the brains of a group of Romanian orphans to those of children raised outside orphanages.
Finally, when the kids were 8 to 10, we did magnetic resonance imaging on them, where we could actually look at detailed anatomy in the brains. And that was the most disconcerting because we found that the kids in the institutional group had much smaller brains, which probably is why they had less brain activity.
This can translate into problems with attention deficit disorder, anxiety disorders, and attachment issues. Dr. Nelson says there are lessons here for American children.
Not surprisingly, kids who grow up in families where there's a lot of maltreatment and then are placed in bad foster care and then one foster care and another, they look just like our kids in Romania. So when people say to me, well, who cares about these children in institutions in Romania? Because it's a model system for what happens in the United States every day.
And Dr. Nelson says it's why scientists must take the emerging science out of the lab and into clinical practice.
What I want us to think about is what would you say in the context of our efforts with a parent who comes in and tells you about that development in their interactions with their kid.
Here's the catch, I think. So
at a Mass General Hospital program for children with behavioral challenges called Think Kids, a number of therapists gather for their weekly meeting. Dr. Stuart Ablon, director of the program, says it's important to understand that these are children with brains that are not fully developed. In other words, they don't lack the will to behave, but the skill.
You know what? This kid's doing the best he can with the skills he has to handle what the world's throwing at him. But that runs completely counter to the more common philosophy out there, which is if a kid's not doing well, it must be because he doesn't want to. We've known forever that hasn't been the case. Now we have the science to back it up.
Ablon says these children are not stubborn or unmotivated, but just like kids with learning disabilities, they lack skills because of differences in their brain development.
Except instead of talking about reading and math and writing, we're talking about stuff like problem solving, frustration tolerance, emotion regulation. Those are the skills that these kids lack.
Dr. Ablon says science is beginning to show that brain change can happen, especially when children are helped to repeatedly practice skills they lack in trusting relationships.
When the child is asked to, for instance, turn off the video game and start doing their homework, and they begin to escalate, if the adult in that moment can be the one to stay calm and empathize with the child, the child's actually going to start to calm down and be open then to hearing the adult perspective about the problem and being invited to problem solve. It's that type of interaction again and again and again that is the dosing needed to facilitate brain change.
But brain change gets harder as time passes, says Dr. Charles Nelson of Children's Hospital.
Interventions done later in life will likely be less successful in rerouting the brain wiring than interventions done earlier in life.
The cost of delaying is huge, not only in human terms, but also financial. A recent CDC study found the total lifetime estimated costs associated with just 1 year of childhood maltreatment is approximately $124 billion.
As recently as 10 years ago, we could shrug our shoulders and say, you know, I feel bad that this child is neglected, but it's not my problem. Now we can't say that anymore. It is our problem. It's everybody's problem.
Dr. Jack Shonkoff, head of Harvard Center on the Developing Child, says we should respond as urgently to the scourge of childhood abuse and neglect as we have to other public health threats.
The science makes it more difficult to walk away. Once you know the science, now you have a moral responsibility to say we can't allow this to go by. That's what the scientific understanding has done.
For Here and Now, I'm Iris Adler.
Okay, pop quiz. What's the most innovative country in the world? We'll give you a second or two to think about it. And did you come up with an answer? Was your answer Switzerland? Well, that's at least according to analysts at Cornell University and the UN's World Intellectual Property Association. They recently put out their annual Global Innovation Index. Switzerland ranked at the top. Where did the U.S. rank? Number 6. Ouch. Joe Weisenthal has been looking at the report. He's executive editor of Business Insider, and he joins us now from NPR in New York. Welcome back to the show, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so at least we're in the top 10. That's a small consolation.
Yeah, you know, I don't think 6 is that bad. There are a lot of countries in the world, and, you know, 6 is still really high up there. So okay. I think we're still doing okay.
Not too bad. But what did the report look at exactly?
Yeah, I mean, these kind of reports, certain criteria, intellectual property is a big one. Ease of doing business is another factor to attempt to rank countries for, like, how much, how innovative the country is. Theoretically, it's a guide to where businesses might want to locate and do businesses. Switzerland always tends to do really well in this report. There's sort of like extraordinary industrial story, very incredibly advanced country technologically. I mean, they're basically famous for hundreds of years for their technical excellence. So it's not a surprise. The U.S., I mean, you know, if you're disappointed by the sixth place, it sometimes gets dinged for some of the difficulty of doing business here, regulation and so forth. You know, like I said, I still think we're doing pretty well.
Although, according to the index, we backslid from number 5, where we ranked last year. And rounding out this year's top 5, the United Kingdom at number 2, Sweden at number 3, then Finland, then the Netherlands. So Europe.
Right.
But on the other end of the index, something interesting apparently is happening with sub-Saharan Africa. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, there's been a pretty the best improvement is happening in these sub-Saharan African countries. And I think that's exciting. I mean, people have been talking about when sort of sub-Saharan African countries would experience the same emerging markets boom that we've seen in parts of Asia and South America and so forth. And there's been a lot of promise of that and then disappointment and backsliding and so forth. But, you know, there is overall progress and things like this, like improving the innovation climate in these countries is an important factor.
Nevertheless, the researchers in this report found that there's this continuing global innovation divide. What do they mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's one of these things. There are certain places that are just absolute hotspots for innovation. We know where a lot of them are. There's Silicon Valley, and then, you know, you look out to then other parts of – so even within the U.S., there's a massive divide. There's a network effect of innovation. So researchers and companies, universities, grants, they tend to cluster around certain areas. If you're not in one of those areas, whether it's a country or a particular city, you want to get to those areas. And then, of course, that leaves some places parched for innovation.
Mm. Now, I read that President Obama today signed legislation to strengthen federal job training programs. He said there's a skill gap preventing many unemployed Americans from qualifying for new jobs. So maybe that's a step forward in terms of getting the U.S. to eke up in the rankings a bit.
Yeah, I mean, anything, it's going to be, you know, it's small bore stuff, these federal, anything that Obama signs as an executive order. I think there is evidence that there is a skill gap in the U.S. There are a lot of jobs going unfilled.
Yeah.
There still aren't enough jobs open, but there are a lot of jobs opening, a lot of jobs unfilled. So that is an issue, and hopefully we can improve on that a little bit.
Joe Weisenthal, Executive Director of Business Insider. Thanks as always, Joe.
Thank you.
There is still work to do to get to a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. That's what Secretary of State John Kerry said today from Israel, where he met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. Meanwhile, the fighting raged on in Gaza, which is just one of many foreign policy crises facing the Obama administration right now. And here to talk about that is Nicholas Burns of Harvard's Kennedy School. He was U.S. ambassador to NATO and served on the National Security Council under Presidents Bush and Clinton. He's with us from New York. Nick, welcome back.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with the crisis in Gaza. And we should remember that this entire thing started after three Israelis were kidnapped and killed. Now we have reached basically a full-scale war in which hundreds of people have died. Do you consider that a failure of U.S. foreign policy?
I don't. I don't think you can hold President Obama or the United States responsible for this. You have to hold Israel and the Palestinians responsible. I would say objectively, Hamas started this. Hamas has fired missiles indiscriminately and cynically at Israeli cities. And if there's one principle that I think most people can agree on, you have a right to defend yourself. And so Israel has a right to defend itself from these rockets. On the other hand, Israel cannot hope to win a military victory over Hamas. Gaza is one of the most densely populated places on earth. It's Hamas's home territory. Hamas has proven to be effective in that kind of street-to-street fighting. So I think that the U.S. calculation that Secretary Kerry and President Obama are operating under, that we've got to achieve a ceasefire, is the right one, because neither side can win this. There's intolerable bloodshed. Israelis shouldn't have to live in bomb shelters, and the number of dead, particularly children, in Gaza among the Palestinians is simply intolerable. So I think the U.S. actually is right to try to stop this fighting for both sides.
But if neither side can win this, then shouldn't the U.S. have made a bigger effort early on to try to stop any retaliation from going on at all and just get the two sides talking to each other?
Well, I think the U.S. did do that. Certainly, that's what the White House and the State Department were trying to do. But, this crisis snowballed, as you know. But once Hamas began to fire tens of rockets on a daily basis towards Jerusalem, towards Haifa, towards Tel Aviv, towards Ashdod and Ashkelon, the Israelis had to protect their civilian population. I think there's widespread international understanding of that point. Where I think the Israeli consensus has broken down is now the fact that Israel has taken the war in such a tough way, an unyielding way, right into Gaza, into civilian neighborhoods. Now, I think the Israeli government is an ethical government. I think it's trying to get at Hamas. But when you launch airstrikes, invariably there'll be civilian casualties. And we've seen that now in the hundreds in Gaza. So I do think that the ceasefire is needed. Now, what the Israelis would like, they'd like a ceasefire agreement that entails a commitment by Hamas to dismantle some of the network of tunnels that go into the state of Israel from Gaza that present a long-term threat to Israeli towns near Gaza. That's going to be difficult to negotiate. And the other problem is, Jeremy, that there really isn't an Arab interlocutor who can speak for Hamas. Egypt is now quite hostile, the Egyptian government, to Hamas. Qatar might be one of those countries. Turkey might be another. It's a non-Arab country, but it's Muslim. I think Secretary Kerry is looking for another Arab leader who can help convince Hamas to do the right thing and to stop the rockets on Israel.
Well, let's talk about the other major crisis going on right now, and that would be what's happening in Ukraine after this plane was shot down. Arizona Senator John McCain says the White House was cowardly, that's his word, because it did not arm the Ukrainian government when pro-Russian rebels started taking up arms in the east of Ukraine. He says with U.S. arms, the Ukrainian government would be in charge of the whole country and we would have avoided the airplane being shot down. What are your thoughts on that kind of criticism, which is not just coming from him?
Well, I think that what President Obama has been trying to do is to unite NATO on this issue, to establish tough sanctions against the Russian government, because Putin is clearly sending sophisticated military technology to these Russian separatists in Ukraine, including that SA-11 weapon system that shot down the Malaysian airliner. That American effort has not gone so well because the Europeans have balked and resisted the kind of tough sanctions that the U.S. is willing to undertake. Why? Because Europe is hooked on Russian natural gas. Europe has a big trading relationship with Russia that they don't want to put under threat.
Even with the plane being shot down, you don't think that was a game changer for Europe?
I do think it's a game changer. I think you're already beginning to see the United Kingdom, for instance. Prime Minister Cameron made a tough statement in the House of Commons yesterday saying that Europe must, for its own self-respect and credibility, now go forward to sanction Russia in a very tough way. There'll be some holdouts. And as you know, the EU has to operate by consensus. So everybody's got to agree among 27 governments. But I think given what's happening, given the culpability that rests with Moscow for protecting the Russian fighters, you will see an a week or so, within the week, tougher sanctions. And I think that's what the president has tried to do. Arming the Ukrainian government itself, I do think there is merit for the United States giving military support to that government so that it can wrest back its own territory, control of the territory from these Russian militia. The Ukrainian military is in very rough shape. It doesn't have modern technology. It's not organized well. It's going to be a long-term effort to help them. But in the short term, we on a principled basis, we should be supporting the efforts of the Ukrainian government to gain back control over those big cities in eastern Ukraine like Donetsk, and that's the center of the fighting today. Without that, Ukraine will be a fractured state, exactly what Putin intends for it.
Well, and this all puts the Obama administration in a very difficult position. The latest New York Times CBS poll shows 58% of Americans disapprove of the president's handling of foreign affairs. That's a 10% jump in disapproval in a month. And at the same time, the polls consistently show that Americans don't want to see the U.S. get more directly involved in these conflicts. What's the president to do in the minute or so we have left?
I think he's got a lead. The polls do show that the American people, after the Great Recession and the two big wars, don't want big undertakings overseas by our government. But on the other hand, we're the global leader. We live in a highly integrated global 21st century where all of our economic and political interests are tied up with what happens in the rest of the world. So President Obama has no choice but to send Secretary Kerry to negotiate the Gaza ceasefire, lead the Western alliance to deter Putin, and cope with all the other problems from the Syrian civil war to the Iraq civil war to the problems of a newly resurgent China. This is a very tough time, and it does call for very strong presidential leadership.
Nicholas Burns of Harvard's Kennedy School. He was the U.S. ambassador to NATO and served on the National Security Council under Presidents Bush and Clinton. And by the way, didn't even bring up Iran, which is another whole other foreign policy crisis. There is a whole list of them. Nick Burns, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
California Governor Jerry Brown signed a new bill into law this week to limit full contact football practice for all teams in public and private middle and high schools in California. The legislation is an attempt to reduce concussions and brain injuries in football. And here to talk about it is the man who sponsored it, California Assemblyman Ken Cooley. He joins us from Rancho Cordova. And Ken Cooley, California is now the 20th state to mandate limitations on full contact training in teen football. Exactly what is your law going to do?
Like a number of other states, it says that in the off season, you should not be doing full contact practice. Full contact practice, sort of specialized term, it actually means you're in a practice, but you're playing a full-on, full-speed, hard-hitting, sort of hammer-and-tongue football game. So the bill says no full contact practice in the off-season. Then in the 30-day run-up to the regular season and during the course of the regular season, your full contact segment of a weekly practice, which here in California, weekly practice is 18 hours. The full contact portion of that practice should be restricted to no more than 2 days, no more than 90 minutes a day.
So you're not actually ending it, though. Why not just go all the way and say no more full contact practice?
Well, because, you know, kids who want to play the game of football, you have to be able to learn the game. And the NFL has been very successful in reducing concussions in practice. By contrast, hundreds of thousands of kids in American high school football programs are getting concussions, and medical folks who've done the surveys say two-thirds to three-quarters of the concussions are coming out of practice when they're playing with their buddies. The third thing the bill does is it says if a child has a concussion, they're out for 1 week. Current law in California is just a single day, so this makes it 1 week. And the bill asks the CIF, the group that oversees high school sports, to work with the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Academy of Sports Medicine to come up with recommended protocols.
But there are critics who say that this law is going to undermine California's competitive edge against other big high school states. And the Sacramento Bee newspaper did a poll, and two-thirds of respondents think that this law is not the right move.
Well, I wouldn't say they thought, I mean, they had a question on it. It's interesting. One of the greatest parts, I'd say, of working on this bill, I had a 30-minute phone call from the legendary coach, John Madden. And he was pretty emphatic. He felt, hey, coaches who can coach are going to coach. Coaches are not going to need 3 hours in a week of hard-hitting practice to develop talent. The game has evolved.
Well, then what's wrong with going all the way and saying, let's just have flag football in high school and middle school?
I wouldn't be a part of that. Life presents challenges. People need to find the toughness and the grit to meet a challenge in front of them, and I think that's part of the lure of football. But the big ad, the big new thing that this bill represents is it will assure any parent in this state come January 1st that if their son or even daughter wants to play football, that there are some basic rules in place thought through with the view to preserving the well-being of their child.
Do you think that rules like this need to be put in place, though, for other sports, other contact sports like hockey?
What I believe is that as this bill shows itself very workable, as I believe it will be, as this rules out as sort of a test bed of how do you take a sport people like and think it through for the standpoint of the well-being of kids, the assurance of parents, I think other sports will start asking themselves, why don't we do something similar?
That's Ken Cooley, a Democratic assemblyman from Rancho Cordova, California. He's the sponsor of new legislation that limits full contact training in California's middle schools and high schools in football. Ken Cooley, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, the global celebration for that other kind of football, the World Cup, is over. But another major international sporting event is set to begin today. The Commonwealth Games are held every 4 years for athletes from countries that were once part of the British Empire. And this year, the Games are being held in Glasgow, Scotland. Interesting, because Scotland is set to vote on independence from the United Kingdom in September. Doug Tribou of NPR's Only a Game is in the land of haggis, Robert Burns, and caber tossing. Hi there, Doug.
Hi, Meghna.
So the Commonwealth Games date back to 1930. Give us some history of the event.
Well, they began in Canada. The first games were held in Ontario in 1930, and they've been held every 4 years since, with a couple of exceptions during World War II. And the games started out pretty small scale. There were 11 countries, and there were about 400 athletes. Today, there are 71 nations and territories participating. All of the countries and territories that were once part of the British Empire, there will be more than 6,000 athletes competing when the games begin, Meghna.
It's a huge number, and a reminder of the size that the British Empire once was, I guess. What sports will they be competing in? And I understand there's some very high-profile international stars that'll be in Glasgow.
Yeah, that's right. There'll be 17 sports with multiple events in those sports. And some of them are the traditional sort of sports that we think of from the Olympics. You've got swimming and diving. You have track and field. There's weightlifting and boxing. But there are also some sports that get a little bit less attention, even if we compete in them internationally in the U.S. You've got badminton. Rugby sevens will be played here. That's going to become an Olympic sport in the 2016 games. They've also got table tennis, lawn bowls, or as we would know it, lawn bowling or bocce. And they also have some fun sports that they include, like netball, which is a variation on basketball that's popular in a lot of the Commonwealth countries. By far the biggest star in the field, there are a lot of Olympic medalists here, but by far Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt is the big star here in Glasgow.
Wow. Just out of curiosity, since this is the Commonwealth Games, do they have cricket?
They do not have cricket included on the schedule.
Okay. Well, then, that's interesting. So the Olympics have the Olympic torch, but the Commonwealth Games have the Queen's Baton, which travels to all 71 participating countries. And you saw some of the baton relay in Glasgow on Monday. Were people excited to see it pass by?
Oh, definitely. There were big crowds all along the route. And the relay began in October at Buckingham Palace. The baton, or baton as they call it here in Glasgow, will travel 190,000 kilometers. That's more than 118,000 miles by the time it reaches the opening ceremony. Jim Boyd is a Glaswegian who teaches phys ed, and he got a chance to carry the baton.
This is probably the biggest event that Glasgow will ever have the opportunity of hosting, because we're not a big enough city to host something like the Olympics or the World Cup. I think it's massive, and for Glasgow and the people, as you can see, have embraced it thoroughly. So I think it's fantastic for the city and for the country.
And inside the baton, Meghna, is a message for the Commonwealth nations from Queen Elizabeth.
One wonders if the message might be tailored for the Scots in particular, who are taking that independence vote from Britain in September, mid-September. So how are the games playing into the politics of Scotland's impending independence vote?
Well, the Queen and some of the royal family will be visiting, and you can find some articles questioning whether that's part of a push to keep Scotland as part of the United Kingdom. Some politicians have vowed silence during the games to avoid politics and the independence vote talk, but they can't seem to quite keep a lid on it. But most of the people I've talked with said they don't think the games will have an impact on how people vote.
Okay, Doug, so before we let you go, any particular events that you're looking forward to?
I'm all about lawn bowls, Meghna. It's exciting. It is like the curling of the summer. So I'll be all over that.
That's terrific. Doug Trabue of NPR's Only a Game is in Glasgow, Scotland, covering the Commonwealth Games. Opening ceremonies are today, and you can link to Doug's reporter's notebook about the games at hereandnow.org. Thanks so much, Doug.
Thanks, Meghna.